Hello, and welcome to The Big Web Show, everything web that matters. I am your host, Jeffrey Zeldman, and today with me is Mike Essel. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
Mike is the dean at the Cooper Union School of Design in New York. He's the designer of books, including Born in the Bronx, a visual record of the early days of hip-hop, which just... And Watching the Watchmen. And he's an ex-co-founder of The Chopping Block, one of the premier design studios in New York from way back in the day.
Early, like mid-90s, way back.
I'm sure you were at The Chopping Block when I saw this. I think I saw you guys had just done They Might Be Giants website, and it was the one, tell me if I'm remembering this correctly, it was a log with a crank.
Yes, that was, that's the one I worked on. That's the first one we ever did for them.
Yeah. Was that Flash? It must have been. No, it was it DHTML?
All animated GIFs, actually. It was right when you could do animated GIFs pretty easily is when we launched that.
And for people who weren't there then, so They Might Be Giants was an indie pop rock band of the 90s. They still exist. They're still great. But if you don't know, because I don't know whether people, you know, some people only pay attention to what's new. Other people, forever. Other people, it's a perpetual present. For me, it's a perpetual present. When I listen to music, it goes back decades, and it's now, and it's everything. But this was the coolest website. I remember just going, who are these people and how did they do this? There were just little characters on this crayon. It was just a few colors because, like you said, it was GIFs. So the fewer colors, the better. And it lent itself to this flat cartoon style that you were doing. They were just these little pixelicious characters. It was amazing. And did it play music? Did it play their music while you turned the crank, or was the music...
You know, it's funny. The first one didn't play music, and then we did another one that had a similar, like, it had presidents on a line, and you could click the presidents, and they would talk, and it would play music, and that was the one we did right after. That was all Flash.
Okay, I saw them both.
Yeah, you definitely saw them both. They kind of happened almost at the same time.
And this was like, they had just started their recording career. I mean, these were two people who basically did... They bought a service, like an 800 number, and you could call for dial-a-tune, and every day they made up a different song. Isn't that how they got started?
Yeah, it's all crazy. They were art students, so they it's basically art rock gone a little bit mainstream. They're and fun
only
clients.
Only a little. Only I can imagine.
Barely mainstream. I guess our biggest claim to fame after working with them is they wrote us a couple songs. So they wrote a song called Oranges and Graphic Design.
Yes.
That we featured on one of our websites.
Your slogan for a while.
Yeah, and they wrote a song called Robots and Graphic Design that we ended up never using. But they were fun to work with because they had just such crazy, weird ideas all the time.
It's interesting. Are you still cordial? Are you still friends with the folks at The Chopping Block?
Sort of. We lost touch mostly. One of the partners, Rob Reed, he started a firm called One Trick Pony, which is they're kind of big, doing really well outside of New Jersey. But they went more of like an advertising agency route than a web design route. So Rob's doing great. I think Matthew, my old partner, he's now at Adobe. And Tom, my former partner, I think is freelance, and he runs Chop Shop, which is like a t-shirt company now.
So the website's still up, but does that mean that none of the founders are there anymore?
I think, I don't want to out them. I haven't been involved in The Chopping Block in many years, but
I see Chop Shop at the bottom of The Chopping Block site. So
my hunch is they're still fielding work from that web domain, but who knows how much of a business is there?
Well, who knows how much of a business is anywhere?
Oh, don't even get me started on that.
Well, I was... So you and I and a lot of our friends were very early starting our own companies, having fun, starting our own studios, doing design for other people. And I'm still doing it, but there's very few. It seems like there's comparatively few of us left. It seems like a lot of people have And yet, it's not a sad story. I mean, I look at what you're doing now. You're the dean of one of the most amazing design schools in the country. So,
yeah, I can't complain. I really can't.
How did that happen?
Well, it's funny. I've been doing freelance graphic design the whole time I've had this job. So I started here as a full-time professor in 2003. So I've been here now for 15 years.
Wow.
I did some freelance web design during that time. I did mostly freelance book design, like you mentioned in the beginning. And it's funny, one thing that happened with my practice is I took a big expert witness job. So I was a graphic design expert witness in the Associated Press case against Shepard Fairey.
Wow.
Which was you remember the Obama Hope poster?
Yes, of course. Right. Go ahead and tell the story.
So there was, I got hired by the Associated Press to essentially prove that Shepard Fairey had traced the image of the original photograph of Obama. They basically wanted me to write a report that said, yes, it was traced. And I wrote that report and did a lot of research. And I also was an expert witness in a case against Disney and Target that I helped the design for Modern Dog in that case. And it was very similar. It was about essentially proving that somebody traced something.
Now, hang on a second.
Yeah.
Let's unpack the feelings.
Sure.
I mean, we like Shepard Fairey.
Yeah, sure.
We like Obama. He made this poster for Obama. If he had drawn it by hand, it wouldn't have been infringement, but if he traced it, it is, or it's more complicated than that?
You know, it's funny. I was pretty adamant in the beginning that I would not get on the stand and say what was fair use and what was not.
Right, and you weren't asked to do that.
No, I was not asked to do that. I was simply asked to weigh in on how he created the poster. Essentially, my question to answer was, did he need the base image to make the poster that he made? And my answer to that question was yes. So in terms of feeling...
Well, sure. Yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. I mean, the way I look at it is that, you know, we all have rights as artists. And not only did the original photographer have rights to that image, but the Associated Press who paid that photographer also had rights to that image. And I, in my opinion, if that image had been used simply to make the poster and that was it, there would have been no case there. But they actually made T-shirts and sweatshirts and sold them through Shepard's company.
Okay.
And that money went to Shepard. It didn't go to the campaign.
Got it.
So that, in terms of feelings, I felt very comfortable taking on that work, actually.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
And there's a case kind of Bloop. Do you know about this?
Oh, yeah. I know that case well, actually. That's the Andy Bell.
Right. So
yeah, chiptunes thing.
So Andy basically used synthesizers to completely recreate Miles Davis's Kind of Blue down to like weird little trumpet slides and stuff. You're saying chiptunes. So did he program it? I don't know how he created it.
I don't know. I just know that genre as chiptune, I guess.
Okay. I had assumed, I know it is a genre. I had assumed that he, like Wendy Carlos in the 60s, that he was in a studio with a Moog synthesizer laying down track after track after track. But probably you don't have to do it that way anymore. I don't know. But, and he'd looked up the copyright for, like, he made sure that he paid royalties on the music and the arrangement. Did Miles' widow get money? Like, everybody got paid. He was trying to be completely fair. But what he didn't realize was that the cover art was also protected. And he made, like, a four-color, obviously pixelated. To me, it was just fine art. He was selling it, but I didn't see it as a commercial product. I saw it as an art project. And he basically, if you wanted to support it, you were paying to help him make the project. Again, I'm not a lawyer, but that's how I felt about it. I get why the photographer had to sue.
Right.
I get why the photographer was like 95, and I'm sure his lawyer said, you've got to sue. You got to do this for all the photographers. If you don't sue. And then there was like this digital lynch mob going after the photographer because they were hurting a nice guy who was, you know, trying to make a fine art piece. So that those was things, a, that's I mean, a they're very thorny.
Funny case. Yeah. I it's funny. I actually know the photographer.
Wow.
So it's Jay Mizell. Cause
that's
he went
right.
He went to Cooper Union. So to me that whole project hinges on one mistake that Andy made, which was that he had the foresight to license the music. And like you mentioned, not the foresight to license the photograph.
If he hadn't licensed the music, he would have been in trouble for that too, I assume. But
yeah, for sure. Yeah. It's funny. The most interesting thing about that for me was when Andy fought in the case. My understanding is that he fought to have permission to speak about it publicly, which is how me and you know about it.
Right.
And on that web post that where he talked about it, my favorite thing was when he asked what was the line of infringement. So he showed different versions of the pixelated cover getting more abstract and more abstract. Mm-hmm. And look, in my opinion, the more abstract it got, the more interesting it was. And the more abstract it got, the more it was removed from the original. I think he was basically two steps too close to the original and needed to be maybe two or three steps further away.
But he had to be close to the original so that you'd look at kind of Bloop and look at this abstraction and go, oh my God, it's Miles Davis as like a computer
thing. But how close do you, that's the question in the case, right? Is how close do you have to get for that recognition?
Have you advised on other cases like that?
No, you know, it's funny. Expert witness case is weird because there's no consistency to it. And on occasion, I'll see a case that maybe I think I could help on. And I might, you know, like stuff gets traced all the time. Stuff gets stolen from designers all the time. Like how do you prove it was theft?
The girl with the pearl earring, he traced, right? Okay, he projected. Right. He's a great artist. He's one of the greatest artists who ever lived. But, I used to think when I was a kid, oh, if you can't draw it by hand, then you suck. And the better you are drawing by hand, the better the artist you are. And, you know, and then I didn't realize a lot of artists have assistants. A lot of artists use all kinds of reproduction methods. It's about taking a vision and somehow manifesting that vision.
Yeah. I talk to students, like high school students, about this all the time. I'll meet a high school student on the road, say recruiting for Cooper, and they can draw. I mean, the shorthand I use for this sort of this joke is that they're so good at drawing that they could render the reflection of the room in the gloss of a fried egg.
Sweet.
You know, that they have sought virtuosity. Yeah. You get what I mean?
I do.
And when they come to me with a portfolio that's like highly rendered drawings, often what I'll say is, you know, in nicer words, I'll say something like, hey, look, congratulations. This is really hard to do and you figured it out. I imagine that you're very bored now.
But that's not art. That's us. Those are skills. Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
It's music has the same thing. And there have been periods, even in popular music, where virtuosity, right? Like from progressive rock to punk rock, this huge change. And you know, both often very good music. And often punk had a lot of virtuosity in it that people aren't aware of because it sort of deliberately obscured it. But a lot of times, like if you listen to Emerson, Lake and Palmer, when I was a kid playing keyboards, I thought, oh my God, Emerson, Lake and Palmer are so amazing. And now there's a couple of songs I can listen to, but I mostly can't listen to it. I want to. I want to be like, I don't want to be judgmental.
Right. I get what you mean. But the virtuosity shines through more than the soul of it.
Yes. It just seems like, oh, this is a this is a technical exercise.
Yes.
Like, okay, the guy practiced a lot.
Yeah, congratulations.
Yeah, but, you know, my daughter draws, and she's very good.
Nice.
She's always been more trying to get to me, what's interesting in her drawings is that she always seems to have the soul, often has the soul of the person she's drawing, or the imaginary person she's drawing, or the anguish, or the absurdity. Like, and then on top of that, she's actually learning to draw hair and shadows and all that stuff. Right. But I think, I don't know. I love Crumb.
Oh, yeah, me too,
man. And he's a virtuoso. But.
Yeah, on his own terms. Totally. That's what makes it so interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But when I was a kid, I look at, like, I don't know, the etchings of a Sherlock Holmes illustration, right? And I think that was great art. And I didn't, when someone would show me, like, a Japanese you know, line drawing with like three brushstrokes. I didn't get it. Or right. Picasso, I didn't get it. I was like, he can't draw. And then, you know.
No, you get it. Eventually you get it. You know, yeah. One of my experiences when I remember finally seeing a Mondrian painting in the, I believe I saw it in the Guggenheim for the first time. And, you know, when you see a Mondrian in a book, it's just, I mean, I don't want to be reductive, but, you know, it's like black lines and colored squares.
Right.
You get it as an impression. But then when you see the painting up close, you're like, man, he was a madman. Like, he moved one line like three times in that painting. He moved it by like an eighth of an inch one time or a sixteenth of an inch another time. You can see that? Yeah, you can see that in the layers of painting. And for me, what that just communicates is obsession. You know, clear vision. He was trying to reach a thing. Maybe I don't know exactly what that was. But seeing him work through that underneath those layers is much more interesting to me than just this sort of what he's known for, so to speak.
What do you teach? You taught typography, graphic design. What were you teaching?
The way it works at Cooper is that if you're full time in your discipline, you kind of run the area. So we don't have majors, but I mostly taught inside graphic design. So I would teach usually the first what we call 2DD or two-dimensional design class, which is in a way the principles of graphic design, but no typography. So a lot of how to tell a story with triangles, you know, how to basically composition, translation, things like that. And then I would teach the first and second semester of graphic design 1 and 2, which is basically your introduction to typography and your introduction to graphic design as a discipline. And excuse me. And then I would always teach an advanced class. So sometimes I would teach identity design, like, you know, what would maybe be logo design at another school. Mm-hmm. Or I would teach, we have a class called Open Studio where the students propose work and then I help them make that work. So it's kind of independent study, but with a whole class. So it varies, but usually I teach in the beginning, in the middle, and in the end of their time here.
Wow. Those are really, I teach at School of Visual Arts at the very end. Mm-hmm. They're walking out the door and I'm brushing dust off their shoulders.
Nice. That's a good way to put it.
But those are all amazing times, right? Yeah, it's like your baby and then when they're a teenager and then when they're a young adult are all, I'm guessing, amazing times. Yeah,
it helps also to teach that kind of range, helps me understand like in a way where the program is, because when I teach an advanced class, I'm getting a lot of students I've never taught before.
Right.
And I can see, you know, like, do they really know this thing or not? And it's helpful actually to do the range.
Do you feel like you really know? I know you're the dean and I know it wouldn't be politic for you to say, I'm just guessing and pulling it out of my butt. But to some extent, do you feel like you're still making it up, still figuring it out?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think one of the beautiful things about doing design for a living is just how much it changes. I mean, you know, you mentioned we started in the 90s. I mean, look, I could still make a web page, sure. I have no problem making a web page and doing the code and getting it online, but it's become much more of a team experience since I did it. It's much more collaborative than it used to be. So it's not that I'm making it up as I go along, but maybe I'm not able to keep up as much as I used to, which requires a little bit of winging it, I would say. It's funny, in design education, I've reached some other, I'm not going to call it a dilemma, but I have some funny questions about the profession right now. Like, I think when I learned graphic design, I was primarily trained as a picture maker. And I think our profession is going much more into systems making than picture making. Mm-hmm. And I'm making a cartoon out of it because it's useful for me to do that. But
you're exaggerating to make a point. Yeah,
I'm exaggerating.
But I immediately thought of Milton Glaser.
Right.
He went to Cooper. As opposed to like a Subway, which is also around the same time as Milton Glaser. Right.
Right.
But
no, and even I think you use Milton for a reason because he went to Cooper Union, right? Milton is a supreme picture maker. Often people refer to him as an illustrator, but he would say he's a graphic designer.
Right.
And, you know, also similar in his generation, like Seymour Quast also went to Cooper Union, who is also well known as a graphic designer, but is primarily an illustrator.
Both still in practice.
Absolutely. Yep. And, you know, it's like, I don't want to describe it as a split in our profession, but it is something I really need to think about in terms of our curriculum. Like, how do we embrace more of this systems making kind of work? Versus, you know, or how do we incorporate the systems making with the picture making is a, let's just say, is something I've been chewing on in the past year.
There's a sort of a dumb correlative to that in web design, I would say, in that originally the people who got into web design, a lot of it was about making cool looking stuff.
Totally.
Making beautiful stuff, stuff you'd never seen before, using the extreme limitations of the screen and making something fun and cool anyway. And then it has become more, you know, as people stopped saying web design and started saying UX.
Right.
It was the beginning of a transition toward a maturity and a more, you know, I mean, a mixture of corporate servitude, but also helping people.
Right,
because like some cool stuff you made that looked awesome in your portfolio wasn't necessarily helping people do anything.
Right.
And the more mature stuff that we have now is definitely helping people, but sometimes it lacks in the fresh visual zest.
Yeah, the oomph factor.
The oomph that we had, like everybody who was, and you know, you can see it even, I mean, I work with people who were, you know, 10, 20 years ago, they were making pixel icons, and now they're sitting in meetings. And of course, they've grown up, and they're doing something sophisticated, mature, and important. But also, I'm torn. I mean,
yeah, I made a joke when I lived out in San Francisco for a year and I worked at Mill Design. So I got to do a little bit of web design again. And one of the jokes I made, and this, I should preface this with, this is not reflective of Mule's work.
I'm sure. Yeah. Okay.
But what I'll say is the joke I made about San Francisco was that, like, somebody would come up to me and say, I need a website. And the joke I would make is like, do you want the one with the little product icons or do you want the one with the lifestyle photos?
Exactly. Thank you.
And really, like, you're right. I got into web design because I like to make stuff look crazy. Like that They Might Be Giants website, when we first started, it got attention because it looked crazy. It's hard for me to go into a mode where I'm mostly making systems to help people. It's harder. It's not what brought me to design, but I'm definitely in the mode now where I understand that that's the most important thing.
Right. It's weird. If you're someone like, let's say, Jared Spool, right? He's been teaching usability for like 30 years and practicing it for 30 years. And he's a designer, a very important kind of designer, but he's not a graphic designer. There's not even a little bit of him that like is into graphic design, I would say.
Exactly. Right?
There's not even a part of him that would enjoy 2 hours on Dribbble. I could be wrong. I know Jared. He's a great person, but I don't mean this in any way disrespectfully, but I could get lost looking at like weird old stuff, and I can get into genre, right? Just like going to a flea market and going, oh, wow, these maps from the 50s from gas stations really look amazing. And then
Right. I'll tell you a funny story about working with Mike at Mule, which hopefully he'll laugh at this, I hope, which is I did a logo while we were there, which was primarily typographic and required me to draw the typeface, which is not the normal work that Mule would take on, right? Normally, Mule does mostly websites. Mm-hmm. This was a branding and a sort of custom illustration job. And, you know, that work takes a long time.
Well, you draw hundreds of things that suck.
Yeah, right. And I had to redraw and redraw, and I kept showing Mike some options, and he pulled me aside and he goes, in typical Mike fashion, he was like, what, am I paying you all day just to mess around with type? And I remember, I mean, what I said to Mike was, yeah, that's exactly what you're paying me to do. But it was this funny moment of like, I would have been much faster if I was just making a home page or an inside page based on an existing template that we had already had approved by the client. There's like a speediness to web design at a certain moment, right? That kind of speed I couldn't bring to cut this drawing this custom typeface. I just couldn't do it. And that in a way, that's like this picture making versus system making split illustrated, right? Was that here I was toiling away with some picture making and my boss was telling me it was too slow.
It's funny. Now I mostly, I ask questions.
Yeah.
I talk to people, and I draw. And I don't mean draw fine art. I mean draw ugly little
thumbnails. No, ugly thumbnails. Little pictures to explain something. Yeah, I do
to
that too. All
to explain long. Something. And then someone who has far more pictorial skill than I ever did, much faster than I ever could, makes the picture.
Yep.
And someone else codes. I think I got into web design early on because I could do everything. That was the other thing.
Yeah, me too, actually.
You're like, you're a control freak and you've had to sit across a table from someone who had power over some aspect of the production and didn't see it the way you did. And so
that's exactly how I got started.
The joy of being an individual artist, a maverick, whatever you want to call it. That's kind of gone. And our work is much more mature and does a much better service for people and the client. But that pleasure of locking yourself in a room and coming out 2 days later with something amazing. We don't really have that. It's more.
I mean, when I worked at Mule, what was really, cause I had been out of the web design business
for like eight years,
I'd been freelancing 10 years? For a while, but yeah, I'd been out for like 10 years. The part that we didn't do in the '90s that we did when I lived in San Francisco was just so much research ahead of making anything.
So which instance, traditional graphic designers had done that?
No, we had done it in a different way. Like I had been used to doing, say, research around the culture of a place and research around the visuals that sort of touch that culture.
Right.
And that kind of research I was really at home with. But the kind of research, say, Mule does, you know, like for instance, when we worked on the San Francisco Opera website, we all went into the San Francisco Opera. We participated in interviews with all the stakeholders. Mm-hmm. And one of the recommendations that Mule made was like, in a way had nothing to do with visual design at all. It just had to do with the approval process. Like for instance, I'm making this up a little bit, but like they might go in and interview people and say, actually, you know what? The bottleneck on your process is this. If you make these changes, it'll be easier for us to do this and you'll get a better product.
Which is design. Yeah, that is design.
Absolutely. But in my
and really useful design.
It took me a while to internalize that as design.
Yes, I know. You're 10 times the designer I am, but I have the same issues. And I support all the things you're talking about. It's just and I think they're great. And but it's still an education for me because part of me, like my gut is like going, because I kind of just want to do everything myself.
Yeah, I'm also in this funny mode where for years I would make a pretty good money doing small websites for people, you know, like a portfolio website for an artist friend or a website for a book launch or something. And I still get those requests, but now it's like I feel compelled to say, well, you know, you could do that on Squarespace in 10 minutes. And it's like, I feel like I'm cheating myself out of a ton of work because most of those people, they get exactly what they want from Squarespace, which I feel very strange advocating for, but I also want my friends to be happy.
It depends. I think I generally turn people to, there's a couple of people I know who are really good web and graphic designers who mm-hmm. still do those small sites. Sure. For relatively small budgets. And I recommend working with them because they're going to do so much more.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Because it's custom. It's bespoke. It's like I could send – like Squarespace to me is like I can send you for this suit and it's going to look like a $500 suit. It's going to look amazing. But – and then what I'm saying instead is like – but this $1,000 handmade bespoke suit, people won't know that one of your arms is slightly shorter than the other. You're just going to look great. You're not going to look, you're not going to look chubby. Like, I'm very chubby, but when I get the right, and this is like, I only dress like a slob or I dress in a bespoke suit like that. That's it. Those are my two.
Nice.
You know, and I think that's, in a weird way, that's what we're talking about in terms of design.
Yeah, I think you're right, actually.
So there's like design with like tattoos, wearing shorts in cold weather, right? And like you just got out of bed and your hair's doing whatever. And then there's this other design where like every inch of your shoes, everything is just like perfect, like you're Beyonce, yeah. Right?
I had this funny talk in San Francisco with a friend of mine who I went to graduate school with, where I was sort of talking about how how generic web design was feeling in the moment, just in the moment. I don't think it's generic at large, but I was really feeling it in that moment.
No, it is. I mean, we can talk about that for a long time.
And he looked at me and he goes, Mike, the way you want to do design is like a hobby.
Yes.
And it really killed me, man, because he was so right.
Yeah, but you know what? That's how Brian Eno produces records, too.
No, I get that.
And like a hobby. I have a friend, Robert Goldstein. He had this band in the 80s, the Urban Verbs, and they were signed to Sire Records. They were like the next big thing. And then one of them got very ill, a health problem, and it basically... Uh-huh. Not the usual. That's not a euphemism for drugs. The person actually had liver failure from just genetic. Anyway, and that was the end. But I got to see like letters. Eno came and heard them and said, I'd like to. But Eno wasn't saying like, all right, here's how we're going to sculpt your career and get you from this, you know, from these 1,000-person venues to these 10,000-person. No, that wasn't him. He was like, I'd like to put one set of speakers playing into another set and put a mic in between them because I think the cancellation on your guitar might be interesting. Like, he was just like tripping. He was just, I really like your sound and it's weird and I'd like to help you make it even weirder.
Nice. No, that's great.
That's what he was saying indirectly. And like, when I think of what he did for the Talking Heads, it was like, you hear their first album with no Brian Eno, they're very quirky. And then Brian Eno comes along and goes, I'd like to just add a weird electronic smear when you do that thing on the guitar to emphasize what a strange musical choice that is. And it makes it much better. But it's, you know, it's hobbyist.
Yeah.
I think I do. I mean, look at Orson Welles, right? Can you imagine if Orson Welles were alive today, someone saying, I'd like you to make... The next superhero movie.
Right.
They wouldn't trust him with a budget.
No, you're right.
Because he'd be going, I think I want to put the camera underground, looking, you know, like he'd have an idea, but it's like an art idea. So I think that in a way.
You would get exactly what I mean. You really do. It's funny. You're one of the few people that I've dropped that hobby line on that seems to absolutely get it. It's like, for me, there's like the way we do design in New York. I don't want to make this about the different coasts, but in New York, there seems to at least be a conversation about how the thing looks like relates to its culture. And in San Francisco, it's like a lot of it is like what it looks like in relation to the speed in which it gets done. And I'm making a cartoon of the problem, but that was what I struggled in San Francisco, because it felt more about optimizing business goals and hitting deliverable targets than it was about the conversation of what the thing was. But that's okay. I mean, this is maybe is my own personal take on those things.
It's also so when you and I started doing web design, it was like when Méliès is at the beginning of filmmaking. Mm-hmm. When you could say, I'm gonna have the guy go to the moon and there'll be bathing beauties there. I don't know why. It's cool.
Sure.
Let's have some color here. We don't have color film yet, but I'm going to hand paint this stuff. When he goes to the moon, it should be hand painted. Just art. And then, you know, 30 years later, they've got like, you know, the Dead End Kids and the Little Rascals. It's a product, right? There's still art being made. There's still some films that'll stand the test of time, but a lot of it is like, it's a factory. They called it the Dream Factory. And I think we're in a mature phase of, I can't even say like, okay, I called a list of, I named a list apart. The slogan was for people who make websites. And that's now that's like the Morton Salt girl. It's so quaint.
Yeah, I get what you
mean.
Nobody
even calls himself a web designer. And when we talk, it's like for web product interaction designers and front end developers who like, like I actually wrote a paragraph about it the other day. I wrote like a whole paragraph and said, that's what some people mean when they say UX. And that's what I mean when I say design. But it's like this whole big sandwich of stuff.
No, I tried to put a class on the books at Cooper Union that would tackle just web design in a straightforward way. And I asked a few people what I should name it, and I considered putting UX in the title, and in the end, I just called it web design.
Nice.
I think because I'm old school, but it works. I mean, the students get what it means when they sign up for it.
My students kind of chuckle when I say that, though.
I know, me too. We had this problem at Cooper Union where we had an interactive design concepts class that was – occasionally would be web design, but often it's much more esoteric than that.
Right.
So some students who really wanted web design, they didn't have a home. So I finally gave them a home. And it's been going well, but it's very straightforward. It's one of our most straightforward classes, actually.
But that's good.
It's good. It's absolutely
a basic thing.
It's needed. Yeah.
Like 30, 40 years ago, you know, it'd be like printmaking or typesetting on a press.
Right, no, and you know what people, I told the teacher, which you'll appreciate, was that, like, I said, when the students add a button or add a checkout button to something, I want them to understand by just adding that button, they've added 10 pages to the site. Like, I want them to understand that the whole thing is a little machine and every piece is related to that machine. And they just need to understand that those relationships are what you're designing. Right, you're not making pictures anymore. You're making a system that connects all those things. So that's been the focus of the web design class. It's been successful.
I want to hear you say that again because it's so beautiful. When they add a checkout button, they've added 10 pages.
Yeah, right.
Because it's when we and that was the problem with our tools initially. Our tools were for screen picture making.
Yep, exactly, exactly.
Right. There's still no way with those tools. Right, to say what happens, right?
Right, exactly.
That's why. Yeah. But once you get people realizing that and prototyping, it becomes easier and easier to say, okay, we're going to design a system and basically use the same kind of components over and over so we can put these machines together faster and faster.
Yep, exactly.
And that takes away from the originality. It's a, in order to have one virtue, it almost seems like you have to have this other vice.
Yeah, right.
Wow. So if you weren't Dean, if you weren't running, by the way, I should tell people, my friend Fred attended Cooper Union years ago when it was free.
Sure.
You just had to be great. Now you still have to be great to get in, and it's still, I think, comparatively ludicrously inexpensive compared to...
Oh, yeah. For private art school, the average tuition at Cooper Union for the School of Art is only $10,000 a year.
Okay, which... is a lot of money, but not.
It's not like $80,000 a year. You know, it's
right.
If you apply to Cooper Union and you're eligible for a Pell Grant, or essentially if you are very low income, you actually still get a full tuition scholarship to attend Cooper Union. So it is still an incredible opportunity, and it is also still the most selective school for art in the United States. We're like at a 6% acceptance rate.
Wow.
So. Yeah, I mean, most art schools are like at 70 or 80% acceptance rate, so it's a much different ballgame.
Well, most art schools are?
Yeah. The acceptance rates are incredibly high for most art schools.
Because there's so many talented people?
I think the better way to say it is there's many people who want to go to art school.
Do they? And when, like, yeah. I've got to hand it to the parents, especially if the parents are poor. I've got to hand it to any parents who support their kids' desire to make art.
Yeah, it's tough. Often what I talk about in relation to my education at Cooper Union is that the full tuition scholarship, like the ability to go for free, basically granted me autonomy from my parents. They, in a way, my relationship with my parents was such that, let's just say, I wasn't seeking permission.
Right.
But once Cooper Union said, hey, you can come for free and we'll pay for your room and board for a year, basically my parents, how do I put this? Their opinion about art school stopped mattering.
I think you said it very well, and yeah. That's great. I know a lot of people don't support it, and I understand. I know in your case it might not have been because they had your best interest at heart. But sometimes parents, they just worry if the kid's going to be 60 eating out of garbage cans.
Of course.
I mean, I studied writing. I got an MFA in writing, and from great writers who were like 50 before they published a short story.
Right.
And they said, I feel really bad. And I also got a scholarship, you know, but they were like, you know, you're going to be washing dishes and working as a security guard and and you have to stay motivated to want to write. And I luckily didn't. I quit fiction because I kept using the people I knew as characters.
Right.
And it was just, I don't know how real authors do that. Like, you have this indelible selfish character and this indelibly envisioned despicable gambler character or whatever, and they're based on your friends.
Right.
That's what you write? You know. I mean, usually the worst character is based on yourself, but the other, I mean, if you're a good writer, you're not writing about nice people being nice.
Right. Nobody would read that. Right.
Let's share a sandwich. It's like, when Itchy and Scratchy turned nice, remember?
Yeah.
Because Marge Simpson had a protest against the violence. They were just sharing lemonade on a porch. That was the whole cartoon.
What's funny about me is that I was the only person I knew at the time who not only did I know I wanted to go to art school, I knew I wanted to be a graphic designer from the point of, like, from when I was like 16.
Wow.
Even earlier, maybe. I could have, my earliest thoughts about design are probably from when I was 13.
Was it like record covers, posters, newspapers? I've
told this story a few times, but the gist is that working in a comic book store exposed me to the band Kiss. And I went to ask my dad about the band Kiss, and he had exactly one record in his collection, which was this record called Rock and Roll Over. And then I took that record to my my junior high librarian, and I said, what is this? And they said, oh, they call that graphic design. We have one book in the library on graphic design, so they lent me that book. That book, it showed examples of graphic design, but it didn't show me how to make it. So then I went to the store to buy a book on how to make graphic design. And then I used that book to basically design my school newspaper and my school yearbook and my school literary magazine. And that's the work that got me into Cooper Union. And what's crazy about all those things is that the Kiss record that my dad had was designed by Michael Durrett, who went to Cooper Union. Listen, this is crazy. The book in the library, the only book on graphic design they had in my library was Milton Glaser graphic design.
Oh my God.
And he went to Cooper Union. And when I went to the mall to buy the book on how to make graphic design, I bought this book called Production for the Graphic Designer, which when I interviewed at Cooper Union and showed my portfolio, I showed all my paintings and my drawings, and the reviewer goes, well, what else do you have? Which is a really scary question when you're a kid.
Yeah.
And I showed him my school yearbook and I showed him my school newspaper, and he said, how did you learn to do that? And I was like, oh, I read this book called Production for the Graphic Designer. And my Cooper Union recruiter said, oh, really? I wrote that book. It's just so crazy that I ended up here, because my whole path to design is littered with Cooper Union people. It's crazy.
I have similar with School of Visual Arts, like, moved here so that my girlfriend could study computer graphics in School of Visual Arts, and then she left me for a professor at School of Visual Arts.
Oh, Jesus.
Which they're not supposed to do. And then I was in advertising, and I was working at terrible places, and then I got at work with Sal DeVito, who was the advertising genius at School of Visual Arts. He was like the toughest teacher at School of Visual Arts, and everyone loved him, and he had this like walls of trophies. He's a brilliant guy. And then my girlfriend was studying fine arts at School of Visual Arts, and now I teach at School of Visual Arts. And then my daughter wants to go to School of Visual Arts. And it's just like, this is crazy.
Nice.
But yeah. Yeah. I remember as a kid, like, going to art stores and getting, like, speedball pens and getting, like, Preston Blair how to draw comic characters and
trying
to do animations, like, in note with, like, flip books and all that stuff. And I remember this is terrible. I was a bad person. I befriended a kid I didn't really like that much because he had a movie camera and you could do stop action animation with it. And like I said, we'll start a little company, like not with money or anything, but we'll make this movie together and we'll share the credit and everything. But it was basically so I could, I'm a terrible person. I just, I'm nicer now.
That's okay. That's
but okay. It was just, you know, that urge to get to the tools and to understand.
Oh no, I remember fighting for time just so that I could learn Aldus Freehand and PageMaker.
Wow.
I know, right? On a little Mac SE.
I love all those words.
It's funny. I absolutely love graphic design, man. I really, even though I haven't practiced in a little while, I will always love it, always.
That's really more than, although you started with web design, really graphic design is your thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Always really type is my thing. Working with type, like type as a material is what I really care about.
Well, it's the most important thing there is. And you know, if you got back into web design now, that's the good news is how much you can do with type.
Oh, yeah. It's like a revolution now what you can do. It used to be all about living within the limitations, and now it isn't about... I mean, there's a different set of limitations, I would say, now, but it's not type. It's not one of the limitations.
Well, performance.
Yeah, exactly. It's much more keyed on performance and usability now, yeah.
But, wow, do you remember, I think you would have started then, like 1996, 1997, Microsoft put up a CSS gallery.
You could
see this, and they did these layouts. It was bad CSS because they weren't supporting it correctly and they were only partially supporting it. But I didn't know that at the time, and who cares? It was the first CSS in a browser, and it went from, because it was like, basically, here's ASCII text and some tags and a style sheet, which is just more ASCII text.
Yeah.
And you've got giant colorful letters. Admittedly, they were, you know, Georgia and Verdana and Times New. There weren't many fonts to choose from. But to me, when they were doing, like, they were stacking type and everything, it had this sort of, I don't know if it holds. I think I last saw this like a few years ago. And of course, we can't really see what it looked like now because our screens are so much.
I know. Yeah, who knows what it would look like now? It's so crazy.
And the CSS that they wrote to work with the bugs in IE3. I mean, we're not going to see what the designers really.
No, of course not. I mean, you know what's funny about this story is that I learned HTML in my Microsoft office in Redmond, Washington, in 1995.
Wow.
I worked there for 3 months as an intern, and I just took it upon myself to get started with HTML when I was out there. And Microsoft didn't even have it on their radar, really, in 1995. And then when I came back from that job, was my immediate start into web design, which is when I ended up doing Doricel.com, and actually when I ended up meeting you, and this is when my whole career went crazy.
Do you remember the first time we met?
You know, we met... I think you were working on the Batman website, the Batman Forever website, I think.
In 1995. We met in 1995.
And you were wearing like a black trench coat, and we were at... what was the... Terry Spataro worked there, I think.
Yes.
What was the name of that place?
Oh.
Site something? Anyway, I stopped by because Inch.com was hosting one of our projects, and you were there... And I remember being like, do you guys know who that is? That's Zeldman, man. He's got a website and everything.
Wow.
Yeah. I mentioned this the last time I was on the show, but you're the first person that ever linked to me. So I'll never forget that.
And what was I linking to? Was it?
I had a crazy personal website where I had made these. It was before animated GIFs. They were server push CGI animations.
Yep.
Where I just had my mouth like yapping, like ah bah 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 bah, and you could just see my mouth opening and closing at rapid speed. And you linked to it by saying something like minty fresh or something. Anyway, it was hilarious.
Your creativity was so amazing from the very beginning. Still is.
Thanks.
Still is. What's it like when you do these book collaborations, right? Are you still doing them?
Yeah, I'm actually in the middle of a book on the Mr. T collection right now.
That's a whole other thing we haven't talked about this time.
Hey, so, Jeffrey, I have somebody coming at 3:30, but I can maybe push him off by 15 minutes if you want.
No, you shouldn't push anybody off.
Okay.
It seems like we only just started talking, but we've actually been talking for an hour. I don't know how that's possible, but I'll have to have you on again soon.
I'd love to.
Thank you. The man is Mike Essel. He's mike.essel.com, Dean at Cooper Union School of Design in New York, designer of books, including Watching the Watchmen, ex-co-founder of The Chopping Block, formerly at Mule Design in San Francisco, a legend and a really sweet person.
Oh, thank you, Jeffrey. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks so much.
All right. Have a great day.
Talk to you soon.
All right. Bye.